hope everybody can find a place here. Okay, good morning. I think we'll start now. Let me see where we are. Yeah. Today, I'm going to say something about user authentication. First of all, I hope that all of you managed to deliver the first assignment. I got a lot of deliveries last night, quite late. But anyway, I think most of you indeed did, so... today, at the end of this lecture, I will say something about the second assignment. User authentication. So here is again the context that we will go over. I'll follow the book in this particular case. Let's start with what actually authentication is. So user authentication is a process of establishing some kind of confidence in the user identity. No more and no less. When I teach my course in behavioral biometrics, I always say that authentication is verifying a claimed identity. So you claim a particular identity, and then you give proof that that is your identity. For example, when I log on to my computer, I type my username, which is my identity, and then I prove that that is indeed my username, and not trying to get access to somebody else's account by showing that I know the corresponding password. Nope, that's not what should happen there. In an authentication process, there will be two steps. The first one is called identification, which means the presenting of your identity. And the second step is actually verification or authentication, so providing the information that can be used to verify this particular claim. When we talk next week about biometrics, I will use identification in a different manner. But yeah, that's within each area of research, people often have their own terminology, and so we have to deal with that. So how can we do authentication? There are three factors that we can use to prove a claimed identity, and you know probably all of them. The first one is by having by something that a user knows, but some kind of secret, like a username and password, like the PIN code, these kind of things, used very, very often. The second one is by something a user possesses or something a user has. Token, smart card, bank card, the anti-new card, these kind of things. And the third one is by something a user is, which is the same as biometrics. Biometrics, you all know, you all have heard the term biometrics before. When you think about biometrics, it's generally what we call biological biometrics. So things, let's say, physically attached to the body. Fingerprint, face, iris, ear, retina, whatever. There is also a category that we say is called behavioral biometrics. So that's not by something somebody is, but something he does. Signature, voice, those are the best known, but we can also look at the way somebody walks or the way somebody types on his keyboard. I see these as three different authentication factors. Knows, has, and is. Some people do distinguish between is and does, so they have four authentication factors, but we'll just work with three. In some cases, having just one authentication factor is not enough. Providing a username and password, just a password, is one authentication factor. Sometimes we need multiple factors. For example, when you go to the ATM and you want some money, you have to provide a correct banking card, so something a person has. And you have to know the PIN code, something a person knows. So there are more combinations possible. Now more and more you can have these one-time PIN codes or passwords that are sent via mobile, so you have to have the mobile, and probably you have to remember a password on top of that. Each of these authentication factors has its specific advantages and disadvantages, obviously. And there is no such thing as the ideal solution. There's nothing that works in all cases. For a computer, username and password could be could work very well, maybe a fingerprint reader. But if I want to do online banking via calling the bank on my phone, those don't really work. Maybe voice recognition could be used then. When I want to have access to my office, a smart card, a token, could be the best solution. In any case, when we do authentication or verification, that's the same term, we have to think about how. Remember from the first slide, establishing confidence in the identity of the user. We have to think about when we use a particular method of authentication, what is actually the level of confidence that we get? And we can actually define four levels, level 1, 2, 3, and 4, which have increasing level of confidence, from little or no confidence to very high confidence. this is quite at a management level because I did not quantify what the difference is between high confidence and very high confidence, but yeah, assume that there is some, that we can quantify that in some way or another. So there are different levels of confidence that we can have based on the authentication method that we use. And then we can also look at the impact that an error in the authentication mechanism has on a particular organization or financial situation or whatever. And we can look at, we can define low, moderate, and high impact. So anything ranging from not a lot of things, no personal harm or minor harm, very little financial loss, things like this, until people dying, companies going bankrupt, et cetera, et cetera. So we have the confidence level, and we have the potential impact, and then we're going to match them. I will show that by an example. Let's look at the risk is that there is a financial loss due to an error in the authentication mechanism, and I have to see what actually could be the impact. The impact could be low, that yeah, somebody gets access, but financially it will cost me some pocket money, but that's all. Or it could result actually in a very high risk, maybe the company going bankrupt or major lawsuits or whatever, that will cost a lot of money. So I have to do this risk analysis, and at the end I have to decide if this error in the authentication system, what would be the impact on my organization. Once I have determined that, then I have to see what is the appropriate level of assurance that I need. So if I say the impact is low, yeah, it doesn't really matter that much, okay, then a level one assurance is more than sufficient. But if it is very high risk, or very high impact, sorry, then I need to go to level four. And I can do some mapping. I can look at other risks in the organization and do a mapping, and then based on this assessment, I can determine what kind of authentication mechanism I do need. Okay, that as an introduction. The next three topics will be password-based, token-based, and biometric authentication, so the three authentication factors that we described. The most time I will spend on, something somebody knows, so password authentication. And you can extend that by yourself to, for example, PIN codes or whatever. That's all the same. Something, some secret that somebody knows. You have a password or a PIN code in your mind that you don't share with others, obviously. And then let's see what happens there. As examples, I have passwords and PIN codes. We all know them. There's also passphaces. If you look up passphaces.com, you will get something like this. And they have developed a system which said it's easier to recognize something than to remember something. If I have to type a password, I have to remember the password. In this case, you will get a number of faces, and you have been given one of these faces before. And now I have to look at these faces and say, okay, that's not on the top row. Oh, there, on the second row on the left-hand side, that's the face I had to remember. I recognize that one. And then I have to click on that face. And obviously, I have to repeat that a couple of times, otherwise the system would not be very strong. I found this system in 2006. That's a demo that you can go over, and every time for the demo, it's just one fixed set of faces. And every time that I was teaching the behavioral biometrics course, I went back there, and I looked and said, "Oh yeah, this face and this face and this face." So you have to repeat this three times. And every year, I don't do that for the rest of the year, but after a year, I come back and I remember. I still remember the three faces. Once in a while, maybe two or three times in all these years, I had to try it twice. Yeah, I was in doubt, should it be the left or the left face here or the face here at the bottom, whatever. Yeah, but generally I knew all of them at once. So there are different systems also included here. What are the advantages and disadvantages of password authentication? Well, it's very cheap. It's widely available. It's everybody knows how to use it. But there are many, many disadvantages in password systems. And we all know those disadvantages. Who is reusing passwords on multiple sites? Okay. Some of you are honest, some of you are dishonest. Because everybody does that. I do that too. Yeah? Doesn't really matter. You use passwords on different sites. You share passwords. Oh yeah, I'm not in the office. Can you go and check my email? Here's my password. You maybe don't do that often. Your passwords are easy to guess. Your passwords are, maybe if you get assigned a password, yeah, then that would be a bit difficult to remember. Yeah, so there are many different disadvantages with password systems, and we all know about them. Sometimes we have to renew passwords. We use here at HIG, we had a system that every month you had to change a password. And you use that system so infrequently that maybe there were a couple of months that you weren't even using them. But the first time that you had to use it, you just had to ask for a new password because you simply forgot. There are many attacks on passwords, from downloading a full database of passwords and then trying to crack them, up to, for example, workstation hijacking, where I would leave this room now and somebody would come here and start using my computer. Yeah, details you can find in the book. I will not go into that today. But let's look at storing passwords. I said, yeah, it's possible that a database with password is stolen by a hacker, and we see many examples of that in the news nowadays. And let's look at the security there. So organizations store passwords in a database. Unfortunately, and I don't understand this, but sometimes they actually do that in plain text. Yeah. Oh, I forgot my password. Can you please renew my password? And then you get a copy of your own password. That's not that secure. The example I like to use, because I have some statistics on it, is in December 2009, there was a website, RockYou, which had 32 million passwords in a database, and those were stolen. And those were stored in plain text. And just as a test, let's have a simple test. What is the password you use, for example, for your email? Okay, good. You don't say that. But generally, we know that we have to make, let's say, good passwords, strong passwords, right? Let's see what the RockYou people did. What do you think was the most used password? Because it could be that your password and my password, by chance, are the same, right? You generate something random, I generate something random, and we have the same. But what do you think is the most used password? Yeah, he was right already. So it was 123456. Yeah? Is that a strong password? I hope that you agree that it's not. It's too short, it's just numbers, it's ridiculous. 1% of all the 32 million users, almost 300,000 users, were using that password. But that's a bit of a difficult password when typing, right? I mean, I have five fingers, so I can do 1, 2, 3, 5 at once. And then I have to use the other hand, or I have to reuse a finger to type the sixth digit. So on the second place, there was only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can do that with one hand, very easy. And then people got smarter. And actually, they thought that, okay, six digits is too long, six characters in a password is too short, sorry, and it should be longer. And so they tried all the way up to 9. This is not a joke. This is the top 3 of the used passwords. Is that a question? Or? Or he deletes your songs. Or yeah, excellent point. The purpose for which you are using a particular password determines also how strong it is. Getting access to my computer, getting access to my email, getting access to my online sources, my bank, that should of course be a very strong password. This was a website, if I recall correctly, that could combine various social networks. So I wouldn't do that. Here is the top 10. Passwords was actually on number 4. I love you, princess. Rock you, of course. Yeah, if I get a breach in, there was a breach in LinkedIn. You don't see that, rock you, strangely. Yeah, but you will see LinkedIn a lot of times. Know that actually number 10 is the first where letters and numbers are combined. But again, it's very weak. Obviously, we should not store passwords in plain. That was stupid anyway from Okyu. But still, it's done. There was a... just this week, I read something about... I'm not sure if it happened now or earlier. That in Russia, there was a database of nearly 100 million passwords which was stolen, also stored in plain text. But I don't have the statistics on that one. A better way than storing a hash word in plain, a password in plain, is hashing it. Yeah, at the very least, when I look at the stored information, I can't know what the password is. But that's not the best solution anyway, because if two people have the same password, they have the same hash. Yeah, and if the RockYou password was database was encrypted or hashed, then I could still look which hash is occurring the most of the time, and I would just guess that is 123456 or password or one of the top 10, and I could easily find that out. So this is what an attacker will do. He will actually guess a password, and he will hash that password. So he will guess password, and he will hash that value, that password, and he gets a value, and he just checks the full database, and he sees everywhere where he sees that particular hash, that user used the password, or anything else. Yeah. So if I know what passwords are very popular, I'll start testing those first. Yeah, so he starts with common passwords, and he quickly can crack a lot of these passwords. So here is a better way of storing password. We don't store a hash of the password, but we generate some random value, which we call a salt, so some kind of initial value. And don't hash the password, but I hash the salt together, concatenated together with the password. And then I store the salt in plain. The salt, there is no secrecy in the salt. So I store it just in plain. And so that's this process. I have the salt value, I have the password, I hash that, and then I'll put it in the database at the appropriate place. Now if two users have the same password, because the salt is generated randomly, they will have a different hash value stored. Yeah, and at least I can't see that two people have the same password. If it depends a bit on the length of the salt value, of course. If the salt is just, 10 bits long, so 1,000 different values, then if 2,000 people are using the same password, there will be doubles again, of course. Yeah, and here is the authentication mechanism. So what you do is you provide your user ID, you get the salt. This is the salt that you have to use, and you give your password and hash that together with the salt, and then you get a result that should be the same as which is in the table. Yeah, and obviously this is a much more secure system than just hashing or putting them in plain. So how can we attack a database? Well, one way, suppose that it is with salted hashes. One way is just brute force. I'll just try any password, all the way from AAAA all up to ZZZZ or whatever. All combinations possible. I'll just try them. That will take a lot of time, obviously. And I don't need to crack all the passwords. Maybe I just want to crack a sufficient number of them. Well, what if I start with that list of passwords that I know that many people use? And I made a dictionary of that. Dictionary doesn't mean that it is the English dictionary or something, but it is a list of passwords that are often used. And I'll start with those. Yeah, if I would start with 123456 and 12345 and all that, I think if I store a couple of hundreds of those, I can crack at least half of all these passwords. That goes very, very fast. Maybe a couple of thousand. Then there's something called creating rainbow tables. A rainbow table is actually trying to overcome this problem with that salt. And so for each and every password, they don't store the hash, obviously, because there is a salt included. But for they store that hash value for each particular salt value. So they make a huge table, gigabytes of data, terabytes sometimes. And then when they have a database, they just need to look up. Yeah, so it's a trade-off between memory and computing time. It's there. In a rainbow table, you will again use either all the passwords, which quickly becomes too much if the password is of sufficient length, or they will use the dictionary again, where they use the most popular passwords. So anyway, the way to go is to avoid passwords that could be in this dictionary, that are easy to guess or whatever. So what should we not do when we create a password? That's also important to know what you should not do. We should not have short passwords. Yeah, the number of short passwords is so small that I can just try every password. So that's something that we should not do anyway. So up to 7 or 8 characters, I can just do a brute force attack, trying everything. We should not have only numbers. I think that's clear, right? You don't use your social security number or your phone number or whatever as a password. Only lowercase letters also reduces the amount of possible passwords tremendously. Same, only uppercase level letters or only special characters, also not good. Yeah, we should mix those. We should not use personal information. Because if I want to attack you, I don't want any account that I want access to, but I want to hack you. I will look into your history. I will look up things about you, and I will try the name of your cat, the name of your mother, all these kinds of things. Assuming you have a cat. Dictionary words. Shouldn't use them, of course. We mentioned that because that's what the attackers try first. Yeah, but let's take a word and change sneakily the 3 into an E. Yeah, that will be good, right? Turn it around. Now, actually, any of these changes that you can do, a hacker knows. So they're not trying just the dictionary word. They're trying also all these variations on the dictionary word. Changing some letters into capitals or numbers or special characters or whatever doesn't work. Turning it around doesn't work. Combinations of that doesn't work. Don't use patterns on the keyboard. This, at first glance, it looks like a good password. But then if you look at the keyboard and see what it is just diagonally going over all the letters. Don't use password that you use elsewhere. And then again, the same holds as in your case. That depends on what. Yeah, if I sometimes you have to register for these to get information somewhere, and you have a special email account for that you actually don't use, but that's for where all the spam is going. Don't care if the password there is weak and if the password that you use on these kinds of sites is all the same. That doesn't really matter. Yeah, but the password that you use to get access to your computer or to your email or to your bank, those should be separated and those should be strong. Okay, we know what not to do. But what should we do? How can we make sure that at the end of the day, everybody is using good passwords? Well, maybe we could educate the user. Yeah, I'll tell you what to do. Yeah, and how to make a good password and how to remember that. That has been tried over and over again. I don't think we can really. I can educate you. You're smart people. You're doing a master study. You should be smart. You're doing it in information security. So you should have good passwords. In all honesty, who can say that for important accounts, they have a bad password? Okay. That's good. There's some. I know people who have. And I know people who work at a higher level in academia have bad passwords. So you're not the only one. Education doesn't really work because in the end, the man in the street, or the man behind the computer then, he needs something that he can easily remember, and he will easily fall back to something he can, something that is in general weak. Maybe we should not make our own passwords. A computer can generate a long, completely random password with special characters, letters, capitals, numbers, etc. And I'll give you that, and you have to use that. Right, that's better. Well, let's provide a set of post-its also that they can write it down. That's user-friendliness. That will happen. If I force you to use a password that you can't remember, you will write it down. Nothing to do about it. Maybe we should do some reactive password checking. Reactive password checking means that the one that is managing the database of passwords, that he, once in a while, just sees if he can play the hacker and crack some of the passwords that are in his database. See how strong they are. See if he finds weak ones. That's what I should say. But then it actually depends on is your database administrator, is that a good cracker or not? Or does he use good software to do that? Maybe we should do proactive password checking. So having some kind of policy. So you can't select a weak password, because if you select a weak password, you will not be able to set that. You will get a message, no, this is not good. Pick another one. And then we can see that there could be some loose policies like use at least three of these four groups where you look at letters, numbers, capitals, and special characters. You have to use at least three of those. So you have a combination, not just letters or not just with anything. And so that could be a policy. And then you get a password like welcome 42. There is a capital, there's letters, there's numbers. I'm home, right? That is a password that is allowed under this policy. But it's not a strong password. In fact, that is a password that was in use. I had in my previous job, there was a security administrator that was using this particular password. And I knew he was a fan of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Who has read that? Okay. So 42, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. So I asked him, and I saw that he died. I said, is that because of The Hitchhiker's Guide? He said, no. It used to be Welcome 41, but I had to change it. So probably he's not using this anymore. No, he's not working there anymore anyway. But yeah, you can see that this is bad. And the changing of the password from 41 into 42, 43 isn't very good either. If you're ever trying to hack somebody and you find that he used something like this, some structure like this with the number at the end, just try if changing the number helps. If there is a too strict policy, then user friendliness could be an issue. Because if I'm trying to make a password and time after time after time I get rejected, I'm getting a bit upset, and then, could not really be helpful then either. So it should be somewhere between loose and strict. You should be able to still select something that you can remember, but still it should be a good password. We could enforce maybe something like the minimal length, the use of these groups. So these are very simple enforcements. Is that a good idea to do that? Except from the fact that you still get passwords like welcome 42. If I had to use a special character, I put an exclamation point or a question mark at the end or so. But is this good? Well, actually, it will help the attacker. Why? Well, he knows what passwords not to check. Oh, you want letters and numbers. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can forget about that. I don't need to check that. And so I'm helping actually the attacker. To know a bit more about that, let's see at what we call the password space. With capital S, I denote this, the total set of password, and with small s, I denote the size of that, of the password. So the number of different passwords, possible passwords. So if I have a four-digit PIN, I can have 10^4 passwords, right? All the way from 0000 up to 9999. Okay, now let's be interactive and let's see. What if I have a 6-character password? How many possible passwords do I have? 10^6. Okay, that's one answer. I hear 10^6, just numbers. I hear 26^6, the normal letters, or 52 if I allow capitals. Actually, it depends. So I didn't say what was allowed. So if it's just letters, it's 26. If I would also include capitals or numbers or special characters, I always assume 32 special characters. So that's why I get to 94. Yeah. So depending on what you allow in a password, right, characters I can select from. From now on, we'll just assume that everything is allowed. Yeah, so 94 different values for each character in the password. Then there is a concept of entropy, which is simply the log 2 of the number of passwords. What does that mean? That is actually the number of bits I need to describe all passwords. Yeah, so if I have 1,000 passwords, I need 10 bits, because 10 bits is 1,024 different values, so I can use that to map to these 1,000 passwords. For example, let's see what entropy does, what it means in practice. If I have two systems, I have a system A and a system B, and I check the entropy of the system A, which is H, and the entropy of the system B is H+1. So I need one more bit to describe this system than this system. What does it mean if I want to brute force? This is about brute force attacks. If I want to brute force system B, I need twice as much time. Yeah, this extra bit, this can be 0, and I have to do the same workload as for the system A, and it can be 1, and again I have to do the same workload as for system A. So it's twice as much. If there is a system C with entropy H+K, then actually I need to do 2^k times as much work in a brute force attack for system C than I have to do for system A. So that's why we use entropy often. So system C, that's more or less the same thing. So here we have the two systems again as we had before. The 10-digit PIN code. Four-digit PIN code, of course. 10^4, 10,000 different PIN codes. An entropy of 13.3, slightly over 13 bits. And a 6-character password, everything allowed, 39 bits, approximately. Yeah, 39 is approximately 3 times as much as 13. Yeah, but the system is not 3 times as secure. It's actually 2^26 times as secure. So if I can solve the PIN code in 1 second, and I would have the same software and the same performance for the password system, I would need approximately 70,000 seconds to break that. Okay, so all depends on the number of passwords that we have. Let's have a closer look at that. As a basis, we'll just take this 6-character password, and we assume everything allowed. And so when I don't have any restrictions, you can pick whatever you want. There are 94^6 different passwords. For the first character, 94 different possibilities. For the second one, third one, fourth, all of them have 94 different possibilities. So in total, I have 94^6 different passwords. Okay, now some user interaction again. I know that if I just say six characters, you will use A, B, C, D, E, F, right? And I don't want that. I want you to use at least one number. At least. Could be two, could be three, could be even 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I will allow that for now. But if I want at least one number, how many passwords have I then at the end? How can we calculate that? That's this slide, by the way. So how can we calculate that? Actually, the easiest way here, yeah? Okay, that's one suggestion. So I need a number which is 10 possibilities, and all the other ones is 94 to the power 5 then, because I have just 5 left. Yeah. Let me see what the argument was to say that this was not correct, by the way. You are counting a number of passwords twice now. Yeah. First of all, you don't tell me where this particular number is. Yeah. So could be that here is my six characters. I put a number here. And then I can put whatever I want here. But I can choose whatever I want. So here I put a 3, right? That's one of these 94. And I just counted that. But now I count it again when I'm making... When I'm trying to make all of these passwords, I have to select a number. Okay, I'll select the number 3, which I put here. And then I can do whatever I want, and I'll put the number 1 here. This is A, B, C, D. Yeah. So I actually counted this one twice. But actually, I know actually how many passwords I can't use anymore. Which passwords can I not use anymore? Well, it has to be at least one number. So if I have the password A, B, C, D, E, F, that's not good. There's no number in it. Oh, so if I look at all of my passwords and I remove those where there's no number, then all the ones that are left do have a number. Otherwise, I just removed it. So how many passwords don't have a number? Well, they can have a letter or a capital or a special character. 26 and 26 and 32 is 84 in total. Yeah, so there are 84 to the power 6 that don't have a number. So out of my total set, I just take away those that don't have a number. Those are not good. And I'm left with those that at least have one number. Yeah? So simply all of them minus the bad ones. Okay, what if my restriction would be it should be exactly one number, not at least, not two or three, just one. Then your argument, Lena, is getting a bit better, but not completely. So here I have my six character password again, and I have to put a number somewhere. Where do I put it? How many options do I have to put the number in this password? How many places? I can choose one of these six places, right? Okay. So I have six choices for where to put the number. I'll put it here. Yeah, and I'll put a number here. I have 10 different possibilities still left. And then I have to put something on the other 5 positions. So what can I put here? I can do whatever I want. No. I can't put a number there. I can put there a letter, or a capital, or a special character. So I have 84 possibilities there. And there, and there, and there, and there. Okay, so first I determine where to put this particular number. Six possibilities. Then I'll just select randomly one of the numbers. 10 possibilities, and then the rest I'll fill up with non-numbers. Do I count things double? No, because if I put the number here, the number 4 here, or the number 3 here, or 4 here, whatever, those are different. And I just have a single number. Yeah? So that's the way that we count this. How about if we just require a single, at least a number, then it will still be well in the kind of welcome 42, right? That kind of password. So what if we have at least one number, but I also want a capital in there? At least one capital. Now I say at least again. So I have to go back to the way of thinking, not of the previous slide, but the one before. So actually, I can look at the, again, how many passwords don't have a number and don't have a capital, or none of them. So the number of passwords without a number, we had that already, and the number of passwords without a capital, we can easily calculate that also. So I have all my. Low tech. I actually have more. I have the number of passwords that don't have a capital and don't have a number. So I just have special characters and letters, 58 in total, and I should select all of them. Oh, stay. So this is all my passwords, all 94 to the power 6. And there are, before we had a number that, this is 94 to the power 6, this is 84 to the power 6 without letters. And the first slide, I just took everything outside this small circle. Now I also have a number of passwords, 68 to the power 6, that don't have a capital. And actually, there is some overlap between those here and 58 to the power 6 that don't have a capital and don't have a number. So this circle is 84 to the power 6, and this part of that circle is 58 to the power 6. I can do the same trick as before. I look at all the passwords. Yeah, I remove this one, these ones, this circle, and I remove everything from this circle. But now I've removed this part in the middle. I've removed it twice, so I should add it once more in to compensate for that. Yeah. So I have plus 58 to the power 6 there. So say more or less the same trick, except that we have to think a bit about things that we remove twice. We should remove passwords that are not compliant. We should remove them once, not twice, of course, because we just have them once. We can do the same thing as before, but now with not just exactly one number, but now exactly one number and exactly one capital. So we know how we did that with one number. So how should we do it now? Well, we'll start it the same way. We have to have a number. Where should that number be? I don't know. Six different possibilities, and I'll put the number here. I select this one, and I have 10 possibilities for that number actually. Okay, now I have my number. I should put a capital somewhere. How do I do that? How many possibilities do I have to put the capital in this password? Yeah, 5. I can put it anywhere. No, I can't put it here because that one is already taken. So for the capital, I'll put the capital here. I just have 5 possibilities. And it doesn't really matter if I started with the capital and then the number or the other way around. The first one that I place, I have six possibilities. The second one that I want to put in there has one less. And there are 26 of these. Yeah, and then I have to fill up the rest of the password, and that could be letters and special characters. There are 58 of those in total. And that's for the four remaining positions, so 58 to the power 4. That should be 58 to the power 4. Yeah, that's a typo. That's a typo here also. Yeah, I'll change that. Yeah, so in total I have 6 for the placement of the number, times 10 possibilities for the number, 5 for the placement of the capital, times 26 possibilities there. And then I have for the other ones, I have 58 to the power 4. For the other 4 positions, I have 58 possibilities for each of these positions. Yeah, so we can do all of these tricks, right? Let's see what happens if I have 2 numbers. It looks a lot like this, right? Let's see what happens there. Okay, let's create the password again. How many possibilities do I have to put these 2 numbers in? I have to put 2 of them in, exactly 2 numbers. So it's not just 6, right? And how many ways can I select 2 positions? Well, let's just start. Let's put a number here. 6 different ways. And let's put a number there. 5 possibilities, right? What would have happened if I would have picked this one first and then this one? I would have gotten the same password. Same structure of the password, right? So I'm actually counting everything twice, so I have to divide by 2. I'll get to that in the next slide. Yeah? How many possibilities to put in these numbers do I have? How many numbers can I choose? Well, 10 for the first value and 10 for the second value. 10 squared. And then I have to fill up the rest with non-numbers. Yeah, let's look why this is. I just told you why it's not 30, 6 times 5. Because if you make the choice the other way around, you get the same type of passwords. Let's call it like that. And so actually what you want to calculate is the number of possibilities of selecting m objects out of n objects. Cn, m does mean selecting out of n objects, selecting m of them. And all of them are identical. Yeah, selecting out of these 6 objects, these 6 positions, selecting 2. And then you can easily calculate it by that particular formula. Cn, m. It's n factorial divided by m factorial times n minus m factorial. Obviously, n is more than m. Yeah, because if I want to select 3 objects out of 2, yeah, I can't do that. I just have 2 available. Yeah, I could even have done that for 1 object. C6,1, which is what I used in the beginning, is 6 factorial divided by 1 factorial times 5 factorial, which is simply 6 again. Yeah, so here we are back again. These were 15 values. I have to put a number on both of them, and then the rest is 84 possibilities. And there we are. Here's a new type of restriction. What if I require all passwords to be different. Oh, sorry, all characters to be different. Let's see what happens there. How many possibilities do I have here? 94, very easy. I don't have anything to think about. 94 possibilities. How many possibilities do I have here? 93, exactly. I can put there anything I like. No, I can't take this one. So actually 94 minus 1. Here, I've already selected two different characters. And those I can't reuse again. So out of the 94 I have, those two are gone. Etc, etc. And so in the end, I get 94 times 93, etc, etc. If you think this is fun, just try this one. Just try it tonight. Write something, write the answer down and provide it to me or one of the teaching assistants, and we'll have a look at it. So we'll not do that now. In the exam that I had before, there was often a question like this. I wasn't a behavior because I copied this part from my previous course. That could again be a question of counting the number of passwords again in your exam. That's not a promise, that's just a thought. Let's look at the number of passwords again. But now I've written it in terms of powers of two. So I could have said in the first line, the entropy is 39.3, etc., etc. But when you look at the entropy, and I'm now not sure if that 36.4 is correct, because I could have calculated with the wrong number. I will check that. But now you look at the entropy, and you see that the entropy of the unrestricted system is 39.3, but the entropy of when I require two numbers is 36.1. So it's over three bits less. So like 10 times as easy. Yeah, the non-restricted password system has 10 times as many passwords. So I'm really restricting. I'm left with a minority of the number of passwords very easily. Yeah. One thing that I have to remark is that when we calculate the entropy, the assumption that I put on the slide is that we assume that all passwords are equally likely. Yeah, from the RockU website, we see that not all passwords are equally likely. And the definition of entropy changes then, but we'll not go into that now. Let's look at proactive password checking. And what this does is it has a set of weak passwords that should not be chosen. Yeah, and so if you pick one of those passwords or some variation of that, it should raise a flag and say, pick a new one. Obviously, we need to have that storage of all these passwords, and every time we have to check, is this password in this particular list? So that will cost some time. There is an efficient way of implementing this, and that's called a Bloom filter. And actually, your second assignment will be on Bloom filters. It's maybe a good idea to pay some attention now. What is a Bloom filter? Yeah? Yeah, thank you very much. A short break is something. I'm almost done. I'm almost talking for an hour. I guess my coffee is cold by now. Let's have indeed a break. I'm halfway through my slide deck, so that's good also. What is the time now? Is there a clock somewhere? Yeah, I see 12:11 here on my computer. Let's be back in 12:25, right? Okay. Is it on? Yeah. I think we're complete again, so let's quickly continue on bloom filters. In a bloom filter, we'll use a number of hash functions, although those are not the cryptographical hash functions that we talked about before. It's just a simple mapping between any input string and a shorter string. But we have a number of independent hash functions, k of them, h1 up to hk. And each of these hash functions will provide me a value between 0 and n minus 1. And then what I'll do is I'll initiate a vector with all zeros of length n. So index from 0 to n minus 1. 0. All zeros in the beginning. And then I have a list of passwords that are on the not-so-good list. So I have a number of passwords. I have this password, for example. And from this password, I calculate the hash. The first hash. And the second hash. All the way up to the last one. Okay. And so I get k values between 0 and n minus 1, because that's each of these hash values. It gives me a value in that range. And then suppose that one of these values, suppose that this is h. Then what I will do is I look up here, h, and then I will replace that by 1, and I will do that for all the hash values. Yeah, so where am I? There. Yeah, so this bit, because this was the value h, the corresponding bit in the what is called the bloom filter is set, and I'll do that for all. So at the very end, I have k bit set, at most k, because maybe this one will give me the same hash value. Could be, depending on the value of n, of course. Yeah. But up to k bits are set, and then I'll continue with the next password, the same bloom filter. But I continue with the next password, and I'll again look at these k hashes, and I'll set some more bits, and I'll continue. So the more passwords I check, the more bits that will be set in the bloom filter. And at the very end, there will be a number of bits set in this bloom filter. That is training the bloom filter. Yeah, at the very end, I'll end up with a vector of length n, indexed from 0 to n minus 1, and a number of bits are still zero. For all of these passwords in my list of bad passwords, and for all of these hashes, there was not a single combination that would hash to this value. And some of them will be one. There will be at least one combination of a password and a hash function that will give me this particular value. So that's training the bloom filter. I'll train the bloom filter with a long list of bad passwords. Then once I have trained it, I'll start using it. And somebody comes and types a particular password. And again, when somebody types a particular password, I'll calculate all these hash values. Yeah, for the same k hash values again. And I get again k indices for this vector. And I'll check what the values there are. If it points to only positions in the bloom filter where the one bit is set, or a bit is set to one, then I'll reject the password. Because it looks like I picked one of these. But if at least one bit, one of these hash values points to a bit that is zero, then apparently it's not one of these. Because if it was one of these words in the bad list, then that bit would have been set. Yeah, so I get a password, I'll calculate all these k hashes, I'll check these k bits in the bloom filter. Once I see a single zero there, I'm done. I can accept this password. When I only see once, I have to reject this password. That's a bloom filter. And that's what you have to create. There is a problem. Suppose that I'm training the bloom filter with two hashes, H1 and H2, and I have a number of words. Amongst others, I have the word Undertaker, and I have the word Hulk Hogan, and they hash as follows. And then I'll start checking a completely random password. This is random, I guess you can agree on that. And the first hash will give me 665, and the second hash will give me 998. And I'll check, oh, both bits are set. Obviously, this is a good password. That should not have been rejected. But it will be rejected. We call that a false positive. Positive meaning that the Bloom filter says, no, this is a bad password, but it's a false one because it was not a bad one. And so this will be rejected by this Bloom filter. In theory, you can calculate based on the length of the Bloom filter, the number of passwords that I'm training the Bloom filter with, and the number of hashes, you can calculate the probability that you actually get a false match. A false positive, sorry. Yeah. I will go into the assignment later on, but the idea is that you make this proactive password checker based on a Bloom filter. So how to create a good password? I'll told you what not to do, and I told you what the consequences of having restrictions are. But now let's see what we should not do, or what we should do. We should have a password that is easy to remember. I don't need to write it down. I'll know it tomorrow. I'll know it in 3 weeks from now. And it should be hard to guess. Password welcome 42, I can remember. I'll remember that 10 years from now. But that's easy to guess. So it should be easy to remember and hard to guess. One of the tricks that we can do is take an easy password, something that we can remember, but don't use it as is. We should make some changes to that in easy to remember steps, and then end up with something that in the very end is difficult to guess. But we can remember it. We can start with a dictionary word. There's no problem with that. But not use it as is. Not change the easy things like an E into a 3 and or adding 42 at the end or whatever. We should do some more complicated tricks. So we need to do some easy to remember transformations to it. And then we have to see if the result is, and we have to at least manually check if the result is hard to guess. One of the examples that many of you have heard about is using passphrases. Come up with a phrase that I can remember. On many new mobile phones, you can use fingerprint recognition to get access. I can remember that. And then I'll take the first letter of each of these words. O-M-N, M-P, etc., etc. And to make it even more difficult, I change some letters. Instead of the O, I use a 0. Instead of the Y, I use a question mark, etc., etc. I should be able to remember that last one. The sentence is relatively easy to remember, certainly after using it a few times. Taking the first letter of that is easy. In my head, I play that sentence again. I'll type all of the first letters. But the changing might be a bit more difficult to remember. But yeah, should not be too easy. I think the first password is already quite complicated. You're often asked, or in some systems, you're asked to change a password. Use something there that is in the news maybe around that time. So maybe a year ago you could have something like, the situation in Syria is so bad that many families risk their lives to go to Europe. Or use something personal. And you can use all of these kinds of things. Something that you can remember. What you should not do is use these sentences that everybody will use. A small step for man, a giant leap for mankind. We know that? Yeah. Neil Armstrong on the moon. You know the second one also? Yeah, Martin Luther King. Actually, I had to look this one up because I just know I have a dream. I didn't know the rest. There are, in fact, dictionary attacks that are based on these kinds of sentences. Yeah, sentences from songs and whatever. Sentences that everybody can remember. Yeah, they made a dictionary attack for that already. So using these kinds of sentences is not good. Also, you must be aware that if you do this, you're not creating a random password. in a random password, each and every character is selected at random. If I do this passphrase, then in fact I will see a lot of S and T in that, because a lot of words, at least in English, start with those letters. You will see very little words starting with a J. So yeah, in that, in my password that I created in this way, yeah, there will be few J's. So as an attacker, I could, if I know that you're using this technique, I could make a brute force attack that actually takes into account these kinds of things. So that's one trick that you could do. I could encrypt the password. Yeah, so my password is not desencrypted or something like that, because then I have to open my computer to do the desencryption, and I have to do that actually to be able to open it. So that doesn't work. But you can do some easy forms of encryption. You can do Caesar cipher yourself. You can do that in your mind. So I have the password welcome 42, and I'll shift every letter two positions in the alphabet. W X Y. E F G, yeah. O P Q, yeah. And now I've done Caesar cipher in my head, and welcome 42 is a bad password. We know that, but I can remember it. It's easy to remember. The encryption is easy to remember. It's Caesar cipher case too. But the result is difficult to guess, hard to guess. Maybe I change the Y into a question mark again or something like that, to make it even more difficult. There is this, let me see if I can show it, this website from Kaspersky, and you can check passwords. So if I type, Will. Yeah, 10 minutes it will take to crack that one on a normal computer. If I take the other one, and I have to do Y G N E Q O G 4. Yeah, at the very least, you see that from 10 minutes it goes to 4 months. Yeah, maybe 9 characters. This is just 9 characters. Maybe that is a bit too short, but you can really get a better security. And apparently, I got a Ferrari. If you go. Yeah, so you can check. Don't ever check this with your real password. You don't know what they store. They say they don't store anything, but you don't know who is monitoring the communication line also. So shifting in the alphabet, doing the Caesar cipher is something that we can do, and we can do that. We can remember that. We can go over. We know the password every time we go over it, and at some point you know YGNEQOG64. That will come fluently without thinking about it. Another way of encryption is just putting your fingers on the keyboard and then shifting them one position, and then typing your password, not looking, typing the password as you would. Yeah, you're off by one letter. So if I shift everything on the keyboard one letter to the, what is that, to the right, I think. Oh no, this is different. This is shifting a different number of positions. So the W is shifted one position, the E is shifted two positions, the L is shifted three positions, etc., etc. So that was this one. This is the, if I shift my hands on the keyboard. So instead of typing an E, I'll take the letter one position to the right, which is an R. Sorry, the W will be an E and the E will be an R, etc., etc. And I again get something that looks pretty random, but you know how you created it, so you can remember that. Having Norwegian characters in your password, that will boost it. That's always something that people don't check. Yeah, so much about passwords, creating good passwords, and the quality of password systems in general. Time is running short, so let's quickly continue. I'll step on it a bit. If we look at tokens, so something we have, the second authentication factor, in the old days we had these credit cards. I don't know if you know them, where actually the letters were were punched out, so that you could have some higher letters, and you could make a paper copy of that. Those had obviously no security in it. Later came a magnetic stripe, easy to copy also, and no computing possibilities. And then you got different types of more smart devices. First memory was included, and then also computing power. The memory cards, they didn't have computing power yet, but you could store information on them. The drawbacks of any token or anything where you have some piece of hardware is that you need special readers to read this information. And if somebody loses a smart card or a smart token, it has to be replaced. That's costly, etc., etc. The old one has to be blocked. Again, as I said in the beginning, there is not a single application, a single authentication method that is best for all applications. Yeah, we can use cards to get office access. To get access to a computer is not that good, actually. Smart tokens. You got tokens that could indeed also do some calculations. They had some memory on it. We all, or many of us, have these small devices where if you push it from the bank, you get a random number. Yeah, you could use those. Let's quickly go through this. So this could be that's a dynamic password generator. Some do a challenge response, where actually, even though you're inputting the same information every time, the way that it is processed is different because of the different challenges every time. A smart card is a special kind of smart token that is just something in the size of a credit card. I will skip this mostly. So. The next one, the last one that I introduced in the beginning, is authentication by something a person is, so the biometrics. I mentioned already the terminology behavioral and biological biometrics. Biological biometrics, things that are attached to our body. So we know all the examples. Fingerprint, face, iris, footprint, actually. Palm print, shape of the hand, if you want. Behavioral biometrics has to do with the function of the body. So that's the way we walk, the way we talk, actually, signing, signature, ECG, in fact, smell. We can recognize people by the way they smell. I have to train my computer for that, but... But more about biometrics next week. So there, next week I will say about how it works, because in the terms of how it works, it is significantly different from a token or a password. And I will go into some examples of a biometric system. Remote user authentication. It's opposite to local user authentication. When I log on to my computer, it's all happening here in this device. I type a password, it is checked against the stored value in a hashed or salted hashed or maybe even in plain, but it's checked here locally. If we have remote user authentication, I have a computer, I log on, but the checking is happening at the IT services. So my information is sent to the IT services where they check the password and they will send a signal back it's okay or not. So here we have an example. We have a client or a user who wants to get access, and then the host who can do the checking. So in this case, the user will first start by sending his identity. Yeah, that's the first thing that you always do. Authentication or verification is proving a claimed identity. So we first have to claim an identity. Okay, the user sends his identity to the host, and then the host comes back with first it will generate a random value. It's called a nonce. Sometimes it's called a challenge, hence challenge response protocol. It's a random value. It's unpredictable. Sometimes they use time as a value, but that that has some disadvantages also. The host will then send that nonce to the user. Could send it together with a hash function and a function f to combine a number of inputs. Yeah, but that's not, in general, it's not needed because that is information that is already present at the user. But if not, it can send that. The user will then type his password, which will be hashed. So the h function is the hash function. And then the challenge and the hashed password, those are combined in some way. That's the f function. And it does the calculation of that and will send the result back. And then at the host, what will happen? They get the results there. Let me see. There it is. The host will do the same calculation. The host has the random nonce, and he has stored the hashed password. And so he can do the same calculation of the function f as the user has done. And then in the end, they check if the result that the host calculated and the result that the client sent to the host, if that's the same. If that's the same, then it's apparently the correct password that was typed, the correct challenge that was used in the protocol. In this particular protocol, you see that the host stores a hash version of the password, so that's good. No access to the plain password. It doesn't need to calculate. That's one thing, but that's a minor thing, just some computing time. But it's more important that it doesn't have actual access to the password. The nonce is generated every time to assure freshness, meaning that if I would use the same value over and over again, me as an attacker would just have to watch the communication once and then repeat that communication if I wanted to have access. But by choosing a random value every time, we can avoid that. That was a password protocol. In terms of a token protocol, the procedure more or less is the same. You see that it again starts with the user sending his identity and then getting a nonce and some functions back. But only there is no password, there's some information that needs to be extracted from the token to do this, to do the protocol. So I'll skip over that now also. I get a question here online. What is the exact function of the nonce? The nonce is to assure freshness such that when the protocol runs now, even as an attacker, if I record everything that is going on, I cannot repeat it the next time because there is a new nonce value. Okay, about security issues for user authentication. Again, I will do this rather quickly. There is a variety of potential attacks. We can attack the host, we can attack the client, we can eavesdrop the communication, etc., etc. And then based on the authentication method that will be implemented, is it a token, is it a password, or is it biometrics? You see a number of examples of these attacks. Let's see, for example, if we look at replay, which has to do with the nonce, in all cases, we can have a replay of a stolen password, or a passcode response, or some of the biometric template response. If we have stolen that and we try to replay that, then we have to defend against that, and then here is the way that we can. For example, the password that we just had is a challenge response protocol, meaning that the challenge every time is new, and so the replay is of something old, and we can detect that. That's just a different way of showing that. More interested is to go in a number of cases where authentication is used. I'll have to see how far. I'll do the first case, and then I will go and explain the second assignment. I think that's more important. The other case you can read in the book anyway. This is in the United Arab Emirates, and where they had border control. There are a lot of foreigners working there, And for one or another reason, some of these foreigners are expelled from the country. And so they are sent away, and then they have to prevent them from coming back, of course. Apparently, in that country, there are approximately 6,500 people entering on a daily basis, either via land, air, or sea. And the concern of United Arab Emirates is that they don't want these expelled people back. And they wanted a biometric solution for that. And this is what they, what some of the requirements they had: should be easy to use, should be fast, scale to large numbers. Apparently, they're expelling a lot of people. Short acquisition time. So a number of requirements they had. And when going over this, at some point they landed apparently at iris recognition system that they wanted to have. So border control. If you go there, you have to have your iris checked. Okay, in this data, they have a database, and in this database are the irises of expelled people. So if you are in the UAE and you are expelled, your biometric information from your iris is captured, you're sent away, and then if somebody comes, and they have all of that information of many people, and then when somebody comes, they will check the irises, and if the irises are in that database, then apparently you are an expelled person and you can't enter. If the irises, if the iris information is not in the database, you can enter. Is this authentication? I don't see anybody shouting, yes, it is. It's actually not, by the way. What was authentication? Yeah? Verification. So a claimed identity, and then you verify that. Actually, nobody claims an identity here. Actually, the system checks if the identity is in the database. I mentioned on one of the first slides where I said the authentication process is actually an identification where you provide your identity, and then the verification or authentication phase where that is checked. In biometrics, identification actually means a process that is done here, checking if somebody is known to the system. Authentication is, as authentication was in this presentation, checking a claimed identity. So establishing an identity or checking a verified, checking a claimed identity. This is verifying an identity. Sorry, this is finding an identity. Sorry. So a match means you can't enter, and non-match means that you can just go on. Apparently, there are like over 9 billion comparisons on a daily basis. That's 6,500 people entering, yet we have 9 million comparisons. At least in my simple calculation, that means like 1.4, 1.5 million people are expelled from the country. So I'm not sure if the numbers are correct. At least that 1.5 million seems a very high number to me. So it could be that there is something wrong in the numbers that are in the book. In the original system that they had, if you were coming back to the country, you just put some eye drops in your eyes, and the system could not really see your iris very clear, and you could get, let's say, a higher chance of getting accepted. Still could enter again. They changed it, and now that's not possible anymore. It's a distributed system, so all the entry points, land, air, and sea, they have a scanner with a workstation, and then your iris is scanned, and it's sent to some central database where the iris is checked, and then in case there is a match or non-match, the result of the matching is sent back to the workstation. Okay, so much for the next one will be the the other case study. So I will stop here because I want to talk about assignment. Any questions about what I talked about today? Yeah? In principle, it will just pass through the eye lenses. So it will see your iris. In biometric systems, always you get what you pay for. Right, so if I buy a $2 system, that will not work as well as a $200 system. But the better systems, they are able to see through colored lenses or these kind of things. They will really see your iris. Okay. And let me... If there are no more questions, then I'll stop this presentation. And I will go to... this one. So bloom filters. That's what your next assignment will be on. You have to create a bloom filter. Not only a bloom filter, a proactive password checking, I should say. This is from just a copy from the other slides. So bloom filter by itself is this long array of zeros and ones, and a one means there was a password and a hash function combination, at least one, that gave me this hash result. A zero means none of these passwords had, in combination with any of these hashes, will hash to this particular value. And there is false positive zero. So this was a real copy of the slides. You have to make a proactive password checker. You have to make a program that is called check password, check PW, and that should be using bloom filters. And your bloom filter is not 24 bits long, it's 2 to the power 24 bits long. So this N is 2 to the power 24. I don't know what it is, it's like 64 million or something like that. So a high number, 70 million almost. Each of the hash functions will give you a 24-bit value, and which is nice because there are 2 to the power 24, 24-bit values. So any value, any time that I apply a hash, I will get a 24-bit value, and I'll know which bit to set. Know that in MATLAB, because you have to do this in MATLAB, the array is indexed from 1 to n. But obviously, you have to, if the hash value is 1, yeah, you have a password and you hash it, and the hash has, the value is 1, you should set this bit, not this bit. And so be careful there. You will be using 7 hash functions. So small k here is 7. And that means that every time you have a password, you apply the 7 hash functions, up to 7 bits will be set in the bloom filter. Some might have been set before already. I will be nice to you. I will give you a function that will actually provide you 6 hash values. But one you have to implement yourself. So I will give you a description of a hash function that you will have to implement yourself. And I will give you a list of passwords that you will have to use to train the bloom filter. Okay, so what do you need to do? Well, I told you that I will give you a description of a hash function. Okay, you have to implement that in MATLAB. Then you have to train the bloom filter, meaning you have my 6 hashes and your own hash, and you have a list of passwords that I give you, and for each of these passwords, you will calculate the 7 hashes and update the bloom filter. And repeat that for the full set of passwords. So that you have to do. And at the very end, I do want a copy of this bloom filter. So you have to save this value. You have to save it anyway because you will have to write 2 programs. One to train the bloom filter, and I want to use it. You have to write a function called check password, and that function will have as input a password, any password that I want to select. And as output, it should just be a value accept or reject. So if you actually would use one of these passwords, it should say reject. If you use a random password, hopefully it would say accept, but we saw in the previous presentation that, yeah, there could be errors there. So there could be false positives. Yeah, but the output is simply accept or reject. So the word accept or the word reject. Because we're not all experts, I will give you some information. Actually, to initialize the Bloom filter, I'll just say that it is a Bloom filter of length 2 to the power 24, and I will set all of these values to 0. That command will make a variable, BF, Bloom filter, not best friend, Bloom filter, and that will be a vector of length 2 to the power 24, which is huge, 67 million, and all the entries will be 0. If at some point I want to set a value of the Bloom filter, I can say Bloom filter of that value P, or that position P, is equal to true. Or I can set it to 1, or set it to -7, or whatever. But using true or 1 are the more logical choices, of course. If I want to set it back to false, I set BF of P is false, or BF of P is 0. So actually, false is a 0 value, true is a non-zero value. Once you have trained it with all the passwords, you will just save it. There is a simple command for that. If you need it, you can load it again. The training of the Bloom filter, you simply have to go over a long list of passwords. I will provide you with a list of a little over 2 million passwords. It will take a bit of time to train it. On this machine, which is quite powerful, it took me between 20 and 21 minutes. And I was a bit afraid that it would then, on a less powerful machine, would take much longer. But I tried it on my Surface tablet. It took me like 23 minutes. Yeah. For testing the program, don't use the full list, of course. But once you know that your program is correct, just run it with a full list. Okay. More or less, that's all you need to know, except the hash function that you have to make. It's not a real cryptographic hash function, but it just maps any password into a word of a value of 24 bits. This is the way. I look at the password, PW1, PW2, up to PWN, so it's an n-character password. And then I look at all the ASCII values of these characters, and those I multiply all together. But then I'll take that value modulo 2 to the power 24 minus 3, which is a prime. So not modulo 2 to the power 24, but 2 to the power 24 minus 3. And that will be my hash value. Is that clear? I thought it was a quite simple description. For example, if I hash password, small letters. Yeah, if I look at the ASCII value of the small p, it's 112. Of the small a, it's 97. The s is 115, etc., etc. And I'll multiply all those together, and I get actually as a hash value 16,220,922. Yeah, and so I look here, where is that index? Or here, I'll set this bit. If I change the first into a capital, then all of a sudden the ASCII value is 80 and not 112. And so I get a different hash value. If I make it all capitals, I get something different. Yeah, so you can check your implementation based on this. There are some more here. Some more values that you can check. If I don't input anything, if I input an empty string, then I'm actually taking the product over nothing. And that's defined as 1. So if the empty string is that, if that's the input, then the result should be 1. That's not even a special case if you program it in a good manner. Yeah, but here you have some check values. So check if your hash function indeed gives the correct values. Okay, then your delivery. I'll have that on the next slide, I hope. Yeah, I hope so. As a delivery, you have to deliver a zip file again. No need to type a lot of stuff in. What else? Just upload the zip file in as the delivery. It should contain bloomfilter.mat, so this value. And I should be able to load it and check if that is correct. All the MATLAB programs that you write, that will be at least two. One to create the bloom filter, and one to do the checking. All of them I want in there. And the other one, the second one, that should be called check PW, should take as input a string, should output one of two values, accept or reject, because that's what I'm going to check. And then let's say a one-page PDF report, not docx, not RTF, not text, whatever, a PDF report on what you have done. I am also prescribing some file naming. I thought I did that last time, but apparently not everybody understood that. The zip file, the name of the zip file is assignment2_lastname_firstname.zip. So assignment2_Boers_Patrick.zip. The PDF in there, same. And actually now I do have to go to the other slide, because I do want to. Let me see if I'm. Oh. Apparently the streaming stopped. I thought it would be a bit more. Let me see. No, it's not there. A few things based on the deliveries that I got for assignment one. First of all, most of you did very well. Thanks a lot. What I was surprised about is that I got 15 deliveries in the last day. A few of them in the last hour. I've got one actually at 1 second past 12 o'clock. So I'm not sure if I should accept that. I've got plenty that don't stick to the naming suggestion that I have, the naming requirement that I have. As master students, I think you should be able to rename a file, to produce a PDF from a Word document or a text file or whatever. I think that is. Something that is relatively simple. So, at the very least, if you don't stick to that, that will have some consequences Let me put it like this: if you follow this, you'll get some score for that already. I don't bring it from the positive side. So, if you don't stick to that, you don't get that part of the score. Yeah, obviously, that is not worth 7 out of 10 points, but it will be at least one. Yeah. Also, the late deliveries, we should avoid that. I also have to say, there were 15 that delivered in the last day. There were, I think, like 7 or 8 that delivered in the first week. And there was one that delivered on the first day. Was it you? Yeah. So, that was great. Deadline means the final point where you can deliver. But it's you will have a 3-week deadline again, by the way. Doesn't mean that you have to wait until the very last day. I've got a lot of people asking me questions at the very end. I do have, how do I install MATLAB? I've probably